Okay, well, let's turn to Revelation chapter 5 again. Kind of base this in this evening. It would have been ideal, really, if what we're going to look at this evening, it would have been ideal if we could have done it last week. Because if you recall, last week we were looking at something that I called a literary device that the Lord has used to help us understand certain things. And so what we're going to be looking at this evening is another one that the Lord has used as this book of Revelation has been put together. And so it would have really been ideal if we could have done it all at once, but it's too much really to kind of take in. So what that means is we've got to kind of pick up on a few things that we looked at last week before we get to that. But let me just read chapter 5. And I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. Then I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look at it. So I wept much, because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll or to look at it. But one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and to loose its seven seals." And I looked, and behold, in the midst of the throne and of the four living creatures, and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb as though it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. Then he came and took the scroll out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. Now when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth." Then I looked, and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne, the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honour and glory and blessing. And every creature which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth, and such as are in the sea and all that are in them, I heard saying, blessing and honour and glory and power be to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb for ever and ever." Then the four living creatures said, "Amen." And the 24 elders fell down and worshipped him who lives for ever and ever. So, as I think I pointed out last week, the difficulty many people have with the book of Revelation, especially with chapters 6 to 19, is really in understanding how it all fits together. And in trying to work out when exactly the things that we read about, especially, as I say, in chapters 6 to 19, when these things will actually occur, when they will actually happen. The events that you read about in chapter 6 to 19, and if you were here last week, you'll have had one of these sheets with the seal judgments and the trumpet judgments and the bowl judgments, and there's kind of lists the verses there, and it explains some of the things that will happen. And so some people might say, well, are these real events? You know, when it talks about the rise of an Antichrist, when it talks about, you know, wars and rumours of wars, and then it starts to talk about asteroids hitting the earth and, you know, volcanoes blowing up and earthquakes and all these other things. Are these actually real events? Is that how we're supposed to understand it? Or is it all just symbolic kind of picture language with a hidden meaning? Is the book of Revelation like one ginormous riddle that we've got to try and work out? Is that what it is? What's it all about? Some people really struggle with it. And as I say, especially chapters 6 to 19. Some people, I think, possibly start to read the book of Revelation, and actually I've known a few Christians who almost as soon as they became Christians started to read the book of Revelation, because it holds a sort of fascination. And I suppose if somebody started to read the book of Revelation and read chapter 1, well, chapter 1's fairly self-explanatory. I'm not saying it's easy, but it is fairly self-explanatory. And then you go into chapters 2 and 3. And they are not really that difficult. Once you understand that they are seven letters written to the churches, just like the other epistles in the New Testament, Romans and Corinthians and Galatians and so on and so forth, they're epistles written to the church that have a meaning for us. then in a certain sense, chapters 2 and 3 aren't that difficult. Now, I know when we were studying those chapters, I pointed out to you that there's a kind of prophetic element within chapters 2 and 3 that isn't immediately obvious, but nevertheless, you could get something out of chapters 2 and 3 without even knowing that, couldn't you? And then you get to chapters 4 and 5. Well, in chapter 4, whether you actually understand who the 24 elders are and who the four, what the four living creatures are and all those other things, and I did a Bible study on that a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, oh Lord, I hope I haven't made that more complicated for people, because it's not that easy to understand, but at least you can get this much out of chapters 4 and 5. It's obvious that what John is describing there is a vision of what he saw in heaven. So you kind of know it's about what's going on in heaven, and especially the throne room of God. So whether you understand who all the four living creatures are and all that, sort of irrelevant in this sense. At least you know what those chapters are about. It's a vision of what's in heaven, eh? But then you come to chapters 6 to 19, and you're reading about seven seals and seven trumpets and seven bowls of God's wrath that's poured out upon the earth. And as each of these seals is opened in heaven, something happens on the earth. So, and again, I've listed them all for you there on your sheet. So when the first seal is open, it's all about the rise of Antichrist. And when the second seal is open, war breaks out. World war. You know, people ask, is there going to be another world war? Yes, there is, according to the Bible. So war breaks out, and then the third seal is opened, and there's famine, and there's shortage. And then the fourth seal is broken, and there is disease and pestilence. And the fifth seal is broken, and there's persecution, and so on and so forth. So each time the seal is broken in heaven, something happens on the earth. And then you come to these seven trumpets. And when the first trumpet is blown, hail and fire mingled with blood are thrown down to the earth. And the second trumpet is blown, and something like a great mountain, it says, burning with fire, is thrown into the sea. I figure that's a volcano. Okay? But incidentally, we haven't finished with all those passages, by the way. We were just looking at the chronology. Once we've done what we're doing tonight, we start to look at it all in a bit more detail. Well, that's a kind of volcano. And then the third trumpet is blown in heaven, and it says a great star fell from heaven burning like a torch. So something like an asteroid hits the earth. So each time a trumpet is blown in heaven, something happens on the earth. And then you get these bowls of God's wrath being poured out. And each time one of them is poured out again, something happens on the earth. And as I say, some people, perhaps reading all this, are baffled as to what it all refers to. And when will these things be? Or how are we supposed to understand it all anyway? Well, hopefully, last week's Bible study will go some way to helping us understand what the seven seals and the seven trumpets and the seven bowls are all about. I really hope so. Because, like I say, the role of the Bible teacher or the Bible preacher supposed to try and help people, make things easier for people to understand, not make them more complicated. And I really pray that some of what we looked at there might help us to understand what that's all about. The things which happen on the earth when the seals are opened and when the trumpets are blown and when the bowls are poured out all happen during this period called the tribulation. The tribulation is a 7-year period of time that is coming upon this earth. It's not happened yet, but sometime in the future, I think very probably in the near future, these things will happen. It's a 7-year period. And the tribulation, I suggested to you the other week, we should kind of look upon as though it's like a holy war. In which God will visit this world of unrighteousness with his wrath. And so the scroll in the right hand of the one sitting on the throne contains God's battle plan for this holy war. That's what it is. It's the battle plan. And what we have effectively under the seven seals and the seven trumpets and the seven bowls is the chronological sequence of events as they will happen during the tribulation. It's a sort of literary device that God has used to help us keep track of the events as they happen chronologically in sequence throughout the tribulation. Do you get it? So in the order in which they come, seal 1, seal 2, seal 3, trumpet 1, so on and so forth, they are the events that happen in the tribulation in that order. And as I said last week, if you read these passages as outlined there on the sheet, in that order, if you read those passages from Revelation in that order, then what you are reading is what happens through the tribulation in chronological order, in sequence, in order in which they happen. So probably, if you weren't here last week, and you haven't already done so, it'd probably be a good idea to listen to last week's Bible study. Purely because it gives you a kind, it gives you the sort of a key to understanding what those passages, the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and the seven bowls represent, and the kind of chronological order of all of that. Okay, so as we finished off last week, I said, having looked at all of that, if you noticed, if you were paid attention to the passages that we were looking at, in fact they're all listed there, as I say, on your sheet, you will have noticed that there are several chapters from chapter 6 to 19 that were actually missed out. And so as we looked at the chronological events through the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and the seven judgments, some chapters of Revelation were missed out, namely chapter 7, chapter 10, chapter 11 verses 1 to 14, chapters 12 and 13, and chapters 17 and 18 are not in those chronological passages. So the question is, what are these chapters about? Again, it's chapter 7, chapter 10, chapter 11 verses 1 to 14, chapter 12, chapter 13, chapter 17 and 18. What are these chapters about? And why does the Lord interrupt, as it were, the flow of chronological events described in the seals, trumpets and bowls with these other chapters? Why does the Lord do that? And again, you see, this can be a little confusing to someone who wants to read the book of Revelation unless we understand the literary device that God is using. This is another literary device the Lord has used, and if we understand that and we understand why he's done it, it should be helpful to us. So this evening we're going to be thinking about these other chapters and what they're about and why they've been placed where they've been placed, as I say, interrupting the chronological flow of events. Are you with me so far? Good. I hope you are anyway. So my hope is that once we've done this, you will at least be able to understand how the chapters of Revelation fit together and how the things described in these different chapters actually relate to one another. And then hopefully next week we can start to look at chapter 6, verse for verse, and we can go through the seals and we can think about what those things are that are described there. Okay, so what about these chapters then? Chapters 7, 10, 11, 12, 13, 17 and 18. What are they about? Well, what these chapters, you see, what they provide us with is essential information and detail regarding the things that are happening during the tribulation, particularly the things that are detailed in the chronological chapters. Are you with me? They give you essential information and detail to help you further understand what's taking place during the tribulation. So the things, as I say, that are described in the seals, the trumpets and bowls should raise certain questions in our mind. And these chapters are meant to furnish us with the answers, you see. It's kind of like, have you ever read a book or watched a film? Let's think about a film. If you've ever watched a film and you're following the story as the various events unfold in this film, and then all of a sudden you're taken back in time perhaps to something that happened several years before that has a bearing on things that are happening now in the storyline. Do you know the sort of thing I mean? So, when that happens in the filmmakers, well, they have various techniques to enable us to understand that what you're going to see next relates to something that happened some time ago. So, for example, it might just be that some words come up on the bottom of the screen and it says, 20 years earlier, you know, and then suddenly, there you are, you're transported back to something that was happening 20 years earlier. Or it might be that the picture suddenly goes all blurry and wavy and this different music comes on, and then all of a sudden, the principal characters in the story, they are there, but they're much younger. You see, the children or whatever, and something's happening then. And so there they are, much younger. Or it may be that the events from the past, they're shown in black and white or sepia tone to show that this happened a long time before. But you see, the point of doing that and including that is that, you see, it provides the viewer who's watching the film with some essential information that they need to know to enable them to understand what happens in the film. Why the people in the film do the things that they do. You know, it might be that it explains why a certain character in the story is behaving the way he is behaving. It's because of something that happened all those years ago. I think they do that in... watch that film, the Agatha Christie film, Murder on the Orient Express. And all these different people murder this person. And when Poirot works it all out, it's because of the fact that this man murdered this little child years before, you see. So it goes back, and it's in black and white, that bit, in the film version I saw, anyway. So that, you know, you've seen that sort of thing, haven't you? And what it's doing is it's providing essential information so that you can understand what's happening in the story. Another example is sometimes you're watching a film and you're following the storyline, then suddenly the filmmakers take you to something that's happening somewhere else at the same time. And initially, it may appear to have no connection with the main storyline. But at some point, it will all come together, won't it? At some point, it'll all come together, and it's included at that point to enable you to understand the full story as it unfolds. We've all seen that kind of thing. Well, these chapters that we're looking at here, chapters 7 and 10 and 11 and 12, 13, 14, 17, are kind of like that. For example, if you turn with me to chapter 6, okay, let's just read some verses from there. Let's read verses 12 to 17. I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. Then the sky, receding as a scroll wet when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. And the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man, hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? So when you read that, and actually, if you've read what's already happened in chapter 6, well, the question that raises in the thoughtful reader's mind is, well, will anybody be saved during the tribulation? Given that things are so awful and so terrible, can anyone be saved during the tribulation? I mean, think about that for a minute. If the true church of Jesus Christ was taken up to meet the Lord in the rapture before the tribulation started, right? If every true believer has already gone up in the rapture before any of these things started to happen in the tribulation, well, think about it. It is the church, it is true believers who are Christ's witnesses in the world right now, aren't they? Okay. And the Lord, we know, the Lord never leaves himself without a witness, does he, in the earth? Yet the church has been taken up in the rapture. So if all genuine believers have gone, then surely God will not have a witness, will he? And if that's the case, then will anyone, can anyone, be saved during the tribulation? Well, chapter 7 gives you the answer. Okay? It's one of those chapters supplying essential information and detail, and it gives you the answer. For example, if you look at verse 9, it says, "After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could number, of all nations and tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands." Go to verse 13. "Then one of the elders answered, saying to me, 'Who are these arrayed in white robes, and where did they come from?' And I said to him, 'Sir, you know.' So he said to me, 'These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb.'" So what that tells us is during the tribulation, a numberless multitude are going to be saved. Well, okay then. If that is the case, that raises another question in my mind. If God has taken the true church out, and they are his witnesses, and a numberless multitude are going to get saved during the tribulation, well, who are God's witnesses during the tribulation? Because he never leaves himself without a witness, does he? So, chapter 7 gives you the answer. So, if you look at verses 3 to 8, it says, "Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. And I heard the number of those who were sealed. 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. Of the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Reuben, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Gad, 12,000 were sealed." And so on and so forth. It goes through the tribes of Israel. 12,000 from each of the tribes of Israel were sealed. And they are called the servants of God, who are witnesses. So I reason from that, that sometime, perhaps shortly after the rapture of the church, once the events of the tribulation start to unfold, there are 144,000 Jews, incidentally, 144,000 is nothing to do with Jehovah's Witnesses. Their 144,000 is a false idea, as you know, they claim it's this, but I mean, it's from 12 from the tribe of Judah, 12,000 from the tribe of Reuben. They are the tribes of Israel. It says they are from the tribes of Israel. It's nothing to do with Jehovah's Witnesses. Okay? So, once the events of the tribulation start to unfold, there are all these Jews, 144,000 of them, and they realize the truth that Jesus is the Messiah. So, they become converted Jews. They become believers after the rapture of the church has taken place. Now, there's not only them. Because in chapter 11, we read about two more witnesses. This time, these two show up in Jerusalem. "Then I was given a reed like a measuring rod, and the angel stood, saying, 'Rise and measure the temple of God, the altar and those who worship there, but leave the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth.'" So the 42 months of verse 2 and the 1,260 days of verse 3 are talking about the same thing. It's the first 3.5 years of the tribulation. And there are these two witnesses who show up in Jerusalem. And if you read on, they're able to do certain powerful signs and wonders. And many students of prophecy believe that these two are actually Moses and Elijah, who God brings back to be his witnesses at this specific time. So now you've got two witnesses, supernatural witnesses in Jerusalem. You've got 144,000 Jews who now believe Jesus is Messiah. And then no doubt there are many others, Jews and Gentiles particularly, who, once the rapture occurs, suddenly realise what my mum and dad believed, what my brother believed, what my Uncle Fred always kept talking about, that one day every believer is going to disappear. It's called the rapture. It's true after all. And so that happens, and then suddenly you've got a lot of people who all of a sudden believe. Does God leave himself without a witness? No. You say, well, there might be a space of time in between the rapture and when the penny drops with these people. So what? How many Bibles will there be in the world? That's a witness. How many videos and DVDs and messages on the internet like this one will still actually be in circulation? God has a witness. So, in other words, what all this tells us is that during the tribulation, there is evangelism taking place, despite the fact that the church has gone. There's evangelism taking place, and a numberless multitude of people will be saved. So, where do we get that information from? From these chapters that supply us with essential information and detail that you need to know. But those things I've just talked about raise another question in the thoughtful reader's mind, and that is this. If the tribulation is the worst of times, as Jesus describes it in Matthew 24, verse 21, and certainly if you've read through those chronological passages, you have to have come to the conclusion this is a terrible, terrible time. And if during the tribulation this Antichrist person is sitting in the seat of power and he's ruling over much of the world, and actually that man becomes fully possessed by Satan, he's the embodiment of evil, the question is, well, what will happen to those who become believers during the tribulation? Jews and the Gentiles, what will happen to them? Well, chapter 12 tells us. Chapter 12 is another one of the chapters supplying us with essential information and detail. So, if you turn to chapter 12, we'll not read it all, but let's just read a couple of verses. Verse 13, when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. The woman, incidentally, is Israel. And then go down to verse 17, and the dragon was enraged with the woman and went to make war with the rest of her offspring. That is, the people who came to be believers through their witness, who were the 144,000, they're Jews. Okay, so those people who came to faith through their witness, he now made war with the rest of them, those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. In other words, it's talking about persecution. Persecution occurs during the tribulation. In fact, back in chapter 6, it's actually mentioned, because when the fifth seal is broken, it tells us in chapter 6, verse 9, it says, when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar, this is in heaven, the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer, until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren, who would be killed as they were, was completed. And again, it's talking about during the tribulation. So it's saying that during the tribulation there will be this persecution that will result in the martyrdom of a countless number of people. In fact, in chapter 20, you read about the same thing. In verse 4, I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads and on their hands. So the very fact that these people had not received the mark of the beast, it must be talking about people who've been beheaded for their faith during the tribulation, yeah? So in other words, in answer to my question, well, what happens to people who convert to Christ during the tribulation? Persecution happens. Indeed, I would go as far as to say the greatest persecution there has ever been, ever, happens during the tribulation. Okay, that's mainly because the man in the seat of power on earth is this Antichrist. So when I start to think about him, questions start to arise in my mind. And concerning this person, the Antichrist, and his kingdom. He rules over the kingdoms of the peoples of this world. And the first question I have is, well, how does he do that? I mean, how is it that this man is able to rule over the kingdoms and nations of this world? After all, if you know anything about history at all, you will know that numerous people have tried that in the past. There have been numerous megalomaniacs and others who've wanted to rule the world. And actually, they all failed. But this man, apparently, at least for a short time, he succeeds. So how does he do that? And how will he get the people to follow him? And how will he control them? Because he does. He controls them. And again, the answers to these questions are all found in another one of these chapters that is specifically given to furnish us with essential information and detail to answer those questions. This time, it's chapter 13. And basically, he controls people principally through two means. One is through a religion that's set up in his name, and the other is through technology and control of things like the economy. That's what the Mark of the Beast system is. And incidentally, it's another reason why I think we're not so far away from these things, because actually that technology now exists. Now, you know, our forefathers in the faith, they thought, what is the mark of the beast? Is it a tattoo? Is everybody going to have a tattoo? You know, what is that all about? Now we have the technology to control people, to control the money, don't we? We all know that. And so, chapter 13. But then chapter 13 itself raises some questions in the thoughtful person's mind. And the question is, what is the nature of the beast's kingdom, the Antichrist's kingdom? What is the nature of it? Because chapter 13 tells us that there are kind of like two sides to it. There is the political side, and there is also this religious side. There is the political side of the kingdom that the Antichrist, called the first beast, reigns over. And there is also a religion set up in his name that somebody it calls the second beast reigns over for him. So as far as the political side is concerned, how does the beast manage to take power and control over the other kingdoms and nations of the world? As far as the religious side is concerned, how will he manage to join together and unite the various religions of this world and bring them together into one? How is he going to do all of that? And what will be the end of it all? Well, the answers to those questions are found in chapters 17 and 18, which again are chapters given to supply essential information and detail. And the answers are given there. So these then are just a few examples of the questions that are answered in these detail chapters. And there are lots of other questions too that are answered there, and we'll look at those as we go along. So what I want to say then is, by, hopefully anyway, by looking at the scroll sheets that I gave you last week, you will be able to see which passages are chronological, and if you read them in order, the order in which I've given, you'll be able to read the flow of events through the tribulation as they come. But then, I've got some other sheets to give you here, if somebody will kindly give those out for us. I've got some other sheets here which tell you, well, they tell you which are the chronological passages and which are the essential detail passages. So you'll be able to refer to those whenever you read the book of Revelation, and you'll know where you are with it all. Is this chronology, or is it just a passage that's giving me some essential detail? Okay? So on the left there, you've got the chronological passages, and on the right there, you've got the detail passages. Are you with me on all that? And again, the purpose of this Bible study is to try and help you and me to have some kind of method and mechanism of understanding the difficult book of Revelation. Okay, but in closing this evening, let me just share with you another reason why I think this is important, especially at this point in time. You see, it turns out there are some Christians right now, at this point in time, who have started to think that we're in the tribulation now. Alright? Some think we're in the tribulation now. Some of them think we're at least halfway through it. And there are some who think we may be nearing the end of the tribulation. There are some puzzled looks on my face, on some faces. But trust me, there are some Christians who've begun to think that. And actually, if you looked at some websites last year, the latter end of last year, well, according to them, according to some of them, it should actually all be over by now. In fact, I think I read one out in one message I preached one Sunday evening that I got off a website, and this guy was basically saying the tribulation had started and everything should be over by about December 23rd or thereabouts. So that by now, we should actually be in, Christ should have returned and we should now be in the millennial kingdom. I've never been back on that website. I hope the man's apologised. You see, there was a time when if somebody came out and said, second coming's going to happen on such a date or such and such a year, you know, that they were exposed as frauds, you know, and, you know, pranks or else false teachers. I mean, actually, some of the kind of Adventist cults and sects were all started that way. Seventh-day Adventism, you know, in its original form, you know, stated that Christ would come back, I think it was 1873 or something like that. Mormonism started by naming dates. Jehovah's Witnesses famously have had several dates when Christ was supposed to come again, you see. And you know, I'm not having a go. I mean, there have been numerous others that have done that. You see, and then in those days, if somebody did something like that, somebody began to teach, then the mainstream church of Bible believers would say, you don't go there, because that is false teaching. The problem is nowadays, there's something called the internet. And with the internet, it's all out there. Everything is out there. And with the internet, you can say whatever you want on the internet. You can say whatever you think. And it looks to me like nobody monitors anything. And in fact, even if they do, there's nothing they can do about it because somebody's got the website up there. But you see, something happened last year that was one reason why many people started to think we must be in the tribulation. And it had to do with certain planetary alignments. Okay, and the movement of certain constellations that meant certain stars and certain planets lined up in a particular kind of way, which some people saw as extremely significant. In fact, they even went so far as to say they felt it was a fulfillment of Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 to 4. It says, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labour and in pain to give birth, and another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born," etc., etc. And you might say, what on earth has that got to do with planetary alignments and constellations and what have you? Well, somebody pointed a certain website out to me, and I went on and had a look, and I have to say, I give the guy 12 out of 10 for presentation, the graphics were fantastic. I mean, this guy's talking, and he's giving his explanations, and behind him, you can see all the planets moving around the constellations. Fantastic. You know, the graphics were absolutely brilliant. But what he was saying, effectively, is that this planetary alignment was the fulfillment of Revelation chapter 12, you see. And many others were saying the same thing. And that, together with a tetrad of so-called blood moons, which certain people picked up on, had people believing that these are fulfillments of things that Revelation says will happen during the tribulation. But I say, and I know, well, who am I? I'm a nobody. But I say, they were mistaken. I say, it was a mistake. And it was a mistake, you see, they would not have fallen into if they'd understood the chronology and sequence of events as described through the seven seals and seven trumpets and seven judgments. They would never have fallen into that mistake had they understood that. It was a mistake they would not have fallen into had they understood that chapter 12 of Revelation is one of the essential detail chapters, and what it's actually talking about, chapter 12, has got nothing whatsoever to do with astronomical phenomena. And incidentally, I'm not qualified to talk about astronomical phenomena. I couldn't tell you about that. I don't understand that stuff. But I do know this. Revelation 12 has got nothing to do with planetary alignments and astronomical phenomena. What's it about? It's about war that breaks out in heaven. It's about the devil who's cast to earth, and it's about the war that he wages upon Christ and his people. It's a passage about persecution. Who is this woman who it describes as having, who is clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars? It's a picture of Israel, and I'll explain that when we get to it. And well, the 12 stars, go back to the story of Joseph in the Old Testament. You understand why it's described as 12 stars, and the father is the sun and the mother is the moon. Jacob said that. Okay, but just read a little bit further. I mean, it baffles me how people can get so misled. It says, she, that is the woman, bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Well, who's that? Well, if you read your Bible, it's Christ. He will rule the nations with an iron rod, it says in the prophets. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne. What happened to Jesus? He ascended. Where is he now? He's seated at the right hand of the majesty on high. I mean, it's unmistakable, isn't it? So the woman who gave birth to her, no, it's not Mary, it's Israel. Christ came from Israel. I know Mary was the mother of Jesus. But you see, it stands for Israel. He was born of the Jews. He came from the Jews. Oh, you know. But you see, where do people go wrong with all this stuff? They go wrong when they take their eyes off the Bible. If you stay biblical, you'll stay right. You know, people say, oh, it's all happening. And when they say that, I think to myself, no, it isn't. There's a lot of things happening, but it isn't all happening. As far as the tribulation is concerned, it hasn't begun to happen. It's getting ready to happen. I'll go that far. But it ain't all happening. And as for this, if that Revelation 12 was really, if the planetary alignment was really that is talking about, refers in that passage to some things that happen just after halfway through the tribulation. Right? So if we're halfway through the tribulation now, here's my question. Where's the Antichrist? Where is he? Don't get me wrong. I mean, he may be there. And I'm sure you do. And I, in my mind, I see certain political leaders and I think, he's a candidate. I mean, I'm not saying this is the Antichrist. But the current EU poster boy, certainly he looks like the kind of character who would pass for the job, because he's got the looks, he's got the charisma, he came out of nowhere. I'm not saying it's him, But I'm just saying, you know, you watch your news and you think, but so he may be out there, but he's not been revealed as the Antichrist yet, has he? So how can you say we're halfway through the tribulation? And what about the world war? Where's that? Well, I know the Middle East is like a powder keg. I know that. And I know there's all sorts of nations are getting involved in that one, and it's going from bad to worse. It's the beginning of the road to Armageddon for sure. But I don't think we're quite where we're talking about in some of this stuff just yet. So if you keep biblical, you keep right. That's why we need this kind of stuff. I know it's like, it may be a drag, you know, in comparison with looking at some of the detail, but it's essential because it helps us to stay focused on the biblical flow of things. So I hope that will be helpful, and then God willing, next week we'll start on chapter 6. Okay, well let's just have a bit of prayer, shall we, before we close.